here. See if you can still hear me, right? Okay, good. Okay, came in a little bit better, didn't it? When I can hear myself, I know it's working really well. It's like what we said earlier, a very beautiful day today. Really enjoying the opportunity to sleep in some. Of course, it gave me more time to get ready for this. Fortunately, it's just a matter now of, it was a matter of taking a lot of things and just making sure they're in the right sequence, in the right order. In the fourth chapter of Romans, it talks about Abraham and it talks about his faith. And as we come into the Passover season, we can see some fascinating parallels between Abraham and the Father. And we can also see some of those parallels in relation to Isaac and Christ. So what we'll be speaking about today, in looking at the promises, first of all, that were made to Abraham, how they built his faith so that when he went through his ultimate trial, the sacrifice of Isaac, how it gave him the strength to do what he needed to do to fulfill his part in that, and how also Isaac had his part in this sacrifice, that he had to do his part, and the parallels with that and Christ and what he had to do. In Romans chapter 4, starting in verse 16, it says, "Therefore, it is of faith that it might be according to grace, so that the promise might be sure to all the seed, not only to those who are of the law, but also to those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of all. As it is written, I have made you a father of many nations." And we'll see that promise. We will look at those promises later on. "In the presence of him whom he believed, even God, who gives life to the dead and calls those things which do not exist as though they did, who contrary to hope, in hope believed, so that he became the father of many nations, according to what was spoken, so shall your descendants be. And not being weak in faith, he did not consider his own body already dead," and explains why, "since he was about 100 years old, and the deadness of Sarah's womb. He did not waver at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strengthened in faith, giving glory to God, and being fully convinced that what he had promised, he was also able to perform. And therefore, it was accounted to him for righteousness." Abraham, the story of Abraham is fascinating. It is very powerful. And the parallels between what happened with Abraham, especially in the 22nd chapter of Genesis, and the father, and what happened with Isaac in relationship to Christ, is something that we can learn a lot about as we go into this Passover season. I'd like to go to Genesis chapter 12. In the 12th chapter of Genesis, we see that Abraham had been mentioned briefly the chapter before in the genealogy and in setting up the relationships between the various people. But in chapter 12, verse 1, it says, "Now the Lord had said to Abram, 'Get out of your country, from your kindred, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation, will bless you, and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.'" Now, he's told to leave his land and go to a land that he will be shown. You can see this is the first step in a series of promises. The promises really evolve from this to where they ultimately go through several steps. And he's told that his name will be made great, that he will be blessed, and that all of the families will be blessed from the earth because of him. Yes, we receive that ultimate blessing, and that was Christ, descended directly down through the descendancy of Abraham, his birth, the family he was born to on this earth, and through what he did and through his sacrifice. He gave that life, that supreme life, that supreme being, and he gave his life willingly. And in that respect, all of the earth has been blessed, thus fulfilling that in part. It's still in the process of being fulfilled once he returns. That is the beginning of the fulfillment of that. Now, verse 4, Abram could have said, I'm not going to go anywhere. But what did he do? In verse 4 it says, so Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. So he already was showing some of that faith that he was known for, being the father of the faithful, that he knew he'd had this promise from God. He may have had a chance to talk with Shem. The relationships through that time, the genealogies where Shem lived 600 years. There appears to be a little bit of an overlap between Shem and Abram. So he had that chance to talk to Shem and to have some of that faith that Shem had built through what he went through in his life, being on the ark, and all that he had went through his years. The next step of the promise came in chapter 13. In chapter 13 of Genesis, starting in verse 14, it says, and the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, lift your eyes now and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward. For all the land which you see, I give to you and your descendants forever. And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if a man could number the dust of the earth, then your descendants could also be numbered. Arise, walk in the land through its length and its width, for I give it to you. So the first part of that, it said, I want you to go to a land that I will show you and then fulfill these promises. This part of this in chapter 13, that promise is being fulfilled. He's saying, this is your land. This is where you're going to live. Look north, south, east, west. This is where your descendants will be. And that promise being starting to be fulfilled, showing where that promise will be fulfilled. The next place where another promise is made and the promise is expanded is in chapter 15. Chapter 15, verse 1, says, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your exceedingly great reward. But Abram said, Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless? Now, at this point, he realizes that part of the promise is that he had to have a descendant. And he hadn't really said anything up to this point. And so he says, what will you give me, seeing I go childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? Then Abram said, look, you have given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my house is my heir. And behold, in verse 4, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this one shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir. So very specific here, that he will be the blood father of this heir. It's very, very specific at this point, where nothing like that had been said up till now. Verse 5. Then he brought him outside and said, "Look now toward heaven and count the stars if you are able to number them." And he said to him, "So shall your descendants be." In verse 6, and he believed in the Lord. So he's showing that faith. He's still believing after probably at this point about 10 years. And he believed and accounted it to him for righteousness. And we see that quote in Romans chapter 4 that is made directly about him. The next place where there's the promise comes roughly 13, 15, 16 years later in chapter 17. And this is the one where I think we focus more on it than a lot of the other parts of the promises that have been made to Abraham. Because there is a lot of meaning in this promise, the way that it is set up. In chapter 17, starting in verse 1, it says, when Abram was 99 years old, so it has now been 24 years since God initially talked to him in Haran, the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "I am Almighty God. Walk before me and be blameless." The original King James, I think, says, "Be you perfect," if I remember right. But he wants you to live a way that honors him, that glorifies him, that follows him in all ways, follows God in everything, not just the things we choose. And so he's reminding Abraham of that, still Abram at this point. Verse 2, and I will make my covenant between me and you and will multiply you exceedingly. Then Abram fell on his face and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations. This is really a very pivotal point where, at this point, Ishmael is about 13 years old. And he is talking that there's going to be extensive seed. Verse 6, I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you and their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and your descendants after you. Also I give to you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, reiterating the promises that he's made before, that his descendants will receive that land as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. A lot of this is also prophecy that's applicable to the future. But if you really look, from the time that Israel came into the Promised Land, the nations that generally took over the Promised Land, and the nations even that are there today, are descendants of Abraham. The Palestinians, every indication would give that they are descendants of Ishmael or Esau. So therefore, that is still being fulfilled what was stated earlier. Skipping ahead a few verses to verse 15, says, then God said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai anymore, but Sarah shall be her name. And I will bless her and also give you a son by her. So now he's getting very specific, where before it's been more wide. It's been, I promise you, you will have heirs. You will have a descendancy. They will be as the sand of the sea. But now he's getting very specific about this. He's saying that I will bless her and give you a son by her. Then I will bless her and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall be from her. So now we're seeing some of this promise really narrowing down, really coming into where it's being fine-tuned into a point where we can see the direction that it's going. I'm going to skip the rest of that. I'm going to come back to what comes up next here in a few minutes. But let's go next to Genesis chapter 18. In Genesis 18, starting in verse 9, this is when they've come to visit. Christ has come to visit, and the angels have also come to visit with them on their way to Sodom. When Abraham starts asking the questions, what if 50 are good? What if 45? All the way down to 10. And we know what happened there. But in the middle of that, in verse 9, it says, "Then they said to him, 'Where is Sarah, your wife?' And he said, 'Here in the tent.' And he said, 'I will certainly return to you according to the time of life, and behold, Sarah, your wife, shall have a son.' And Sarah was listening in the tent door, which was behind him." Verse 11, "Now Abraham and Sarah were old, well advanced in age, and Sarah had passed the age of childbearing." She was 89 years old. Now, let's kind of stop and think about something here for a minute. Abraham's 99. Sarah's 89. I think it would be very difficult to have a child at the age of 89, especially the way things are today. Back then, you think about it, still wouldn't be easy because there was a certain time frame that was set up for childbearing, and she had passed that. And it becomes important to keep that in mind because that means her becoming pregnant is a miracle. That her womb had to be opened up. There had to be an egg sitting there waiting to come down through the fallopian tube to be fertilized, and that she had to be capable of being able to hold that child for 9 months. That was a huge miracle. Now, verse 12, "Then Sarah laughed within herself, saying, 'After I have grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also?'" Why did the Lord say to Abraham, and the Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh, saying, 'Shall I surely bear a child since I am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son.'" So here again, reiterating that promise that Sarah is going to have a son. Go ahead a few chapters to Genesis chapter 21. And starting in verse 1 of Genesis 21, it says, "And the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age, at the set time of which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, who Sarah bore to him, Isaac." Now, Isaac means laughter. And there's something kind of ironic in that term because we see where Sarah laughed. Let's go ahead and go back very quickly, though, to Genesis chapter 17. In verse 17, I just want to go there just for a minute. We'll go back there one more time in a few minutes. But in Genesis 17, verse 17, it says, "Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed when he had received that promise at 99 years old." He laughed. They both laughed. That's something that's not thought about. You always hear about Sarah laughing, but not Abraham. That Abraham laughed about this. It's really something kind of ironic. So it really becomes even more ironic that Isaac's name means laughter, because they both laughed when they heard it. Verse 4, "Then Abraham circumcised his son," back in chapter 21. "Then Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him," showing that circumcision was in existence before Moses, where everyone said circumcision did not exist until Moses, those who argue it right here and also a few chapters farther back proves that circumcision existed all the way back to the time of Abraham, for those who will argue that it didn't. Verse 5, now Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God has made me laugh so that all who hear will laugh with me. She also said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? For I have borne him a son in his old age. She really celebrated this. Isaac became very, very special to Abraham and to Sarah, and grew up in a very, very loving home. I'm sure that Abraham and Sarah taught him the words, taught him how he was a miracle child, literally a miracle. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 11 for a minute. In the 11th chapter of Hebrews, the faith chapter, we'll go back there again later on in the message. In verse 11, it says, by faith, Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age, because she judged him, Christ, faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead. Why? Because he did not have any descendancy that would be able to receive a promise at that point, to receive the inheritance that had been set up. Ishmael had been rejected back earlier, where he said that the son that gave the very specific details there in chapter 17. So, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand, which is by the seashore. They were as good as dead, but through a miracle of God, had a child. Just like Christ was a miracle, born of a virgin. That birth was a miracle. So Isaac was also. His birth was a miracle. They grew up. They learned God's way. Isaac built his own faith. And then we get to chapter 22, where we'll spend essentially most of the rest of the message. In chapter 22, starting in verse 1, it says, now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham. Now, I see this from a teaching viewpoint, that you go through and you teach somebody various things. And all of a sudden, you give a midterm or a final exam. That's a test. That's not a trial. That's to show how you've grown, what you've developed. The difference between a test and a trial is subtle, but it's the purpose for what it's been brought to. Is it to bring you to failure or to show you what you've done to be able to grow? A test shows you what you know and what you did not know before. Where a trial generally is used more as a punishment because of something that you did. So it's two different animals, but it's a test that's being given to Abraham. And they said to Abraham, Abraham, and this time he answers. You notice previous times he didn't answer. But Abraham said, here I am. Even though he had carried conversations with Christ before, this time he just answers, here I am. Verse 2, and he said, take now your son, your only son, Isaac. Now, why would he say, your only son? We go back to what was said before. Well, let's go back to chapter 17 for a minute, just to reiterate this. Starting in verse 17, "Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, 'Shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? And shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child?' And Abraham said to God, 'Oh, that Ishmael might live before you.'" Ishmael at this time is about 13 years old. "Then God said, 'No.'" So Ishmael, at this point, this is when God is saying, "No, Ishmael's not the son of promise. The son that I have promised you," implied at least back to 25 years back from here. "Sarah, your wife, shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his descendants after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him and will make him fruitful and will multiply him exceedingly." And it goes through some things there. Verse 21, "But my covenant I will establish with Isaac." So that's why he's saying only son, because it's the only son through the relationship of Abraham and Sarah, not through a handmaiden. The child that came of promise to them. So going back to Genesis 22, he's taking his only son, who you love, and go to the land of Moriah. Sacrifice him there, or offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. Now there's a couple of things I want to bring up here. There's some very interesting points in the last part of this verse. First of all, go to the region of Moriah, which tells you that's an area that's considered Moriah. Moriah is only mentioned one other place in Scripture. Let's go to 2 Chronicles chapter 3. In 2 Chronicles chapter 3, and keep your finger in Genesis 22 because we're going to be bouncing back there a lot. And starting in verse 1, we see Solomon is preparing to build the temple, and let's see where that is. Verse 1 of 2 Chronicles 3, "Now Solomon began to build the house of the Lord at Jerusalem on Mount Moriah." So we see that Moriah is a region there that is a part of Jerusalem, where the Lord had appeared to his father David at the place that David had prepared on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. Now to read that story of what happened there, that's where he had counted the people, and God sent an angel down to kill the people, and it was stopped at that threshing floor. The angel was stopped there, and David built an altar there. This is the same place where they're building the temple here in 2 Chronicles chapter 3. So there was a little bit of meaning for it because it was a place where the killings had been stopped by David through his prayer to God. And then we see that the temple was built on Moriah. Now, in Nelson's Bible Dictionary, talks a little bit about Moriah. And it says, "A land to which God commanded Abraham to take his only son Isaac and to offer him as a burnt offering on one of the mountains. The mountains of this land were a 3 days' journey from Beersheba," which is where Abraham was at the time, "and were visible from a great distance. The Jews believed the altar of burnt offering in the temple at Jerusalem was situated on the exact site of the altar on which Abraham intended to sacrifice Isaac." That's interesting. that the place where Isaac was to be sacrificed becomes the place where the sacrifices were to be taken in the future? That's possible. Later on, we'll see another possibility that is speculated by some people. To them, the two Mount Moriahs mentioned in the Bible are identical. The Muslim mosque, the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, presently is situated on this site. So currently it's in East Jerusalem where the Muslims are controlling. But we see that there's some parallels there, that they feel that the temple was built in this location where they were going to go. Going back to chapter 22 of Genesis, starting in continuing something here about the burnt offering, going back and seeing that he was to be given as a burnt offering. Now, the best place to explain the burnt offering is in Leviticus chapter 1. So we'll take a minute and go through a couple of verses in Leviticus chapter 1. So Leviticus chapter 1, the first several chapters of Leviticus get into all the various types of offerings and what they mean and all that was tied into those offerings and really the specifics of how they were done, because the Levitical priesthood was to do them in a very specific way. So starting in verse 3 of Leviticus 1, it says, "If his offering is a burnt sacrifice of the herd, let him offer a male without blemish." Now, that's very important. The male without blemish has to be without blemish, because what is that sacrifice representing? Christ. Christ was without sin, so therefore the offering had to be without blemish. Could not have any flaws to it. "He shall offer it of his own free will at the door." Now, let's think about, as we go through this, Abraham, we'll see in the next verse, leaves to go. He does the things he needs to do to prepare and then starts heading to Moriah. So he is willingly going to sacrifice his son as a burnt offering. He is willing to do that. We also see with the Father that he gave Christ willingly to be that supreme sacrifice that he became almost 2,000 years ago. So it was done with their own free will. You weren't forced to give this offering. Just as Abraham willingly went, just as Christ and the Father willingly gave Christ. Verse 4, "He shall put his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it will be accepted on his behalf to make atonement for him. He shall kill the bull before the Lord, and the priest Aaron's sons shall bring the blood and sprinkle the blood all around on the altar that is by the door of the tabernacle of meeting. And he shall skin the burnt offering and cut it into pieces. The sons of Aaron the priest shall put fire on the altar and lay the wood in order on the fire." So you can see there's very set procedure here. "Then the priests, Aaron's sons, shall lay the parts, the head, and the fat in order on the wood that is on the fire upon the altar. But he shall wash the entrails and the legs with water, and the priest shall burn all on the altar as a burnt sacrifice, an offering made by fire, a sweet aroma to the Lord." So you see that was to be burned up. So what we will see in the next verse, in verse 3, going back to Genesis 22 in verse 3, what we see is the next day when Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son, and he split the wood for the burnt offering. He couldn't have just split a pound or two. you needed to have enough wood to really build a very, very, very strong fire to be able to totally burn up a body. So he had to carry a substantial amount of wood with him on that donkey at this point. So he split the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to that place of which God had told him. Then on the third day, now this is interesting, it's the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place afar off. Now he's coming from the south and the west, coming up, and there's only a few places where you can see Moriah real clearly from there because of the way that the land is laid out in Israel in that part of the country. But he was able to walk kind of along the edge of the plain and be able to look up into the mountains. And in verse 5, and Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey. The lad and I will go yonder to worship." And I want you to notice the next 6 words. Very, very powerful. "And we will come back to you." Abraham knew that Isaac was going to live. He had supreme confidence that Isaac was going to live. Stating that way right there shows that he had the faith that even if he were to slay Isaac, that Abraham knew that God could resurrect Isaac. He had that supreme confidence which had been built over the 50 years before and the promises that he'd seen fulfilled and the promises that had been made. He knew God would keep his word. He knew that Isaac would live without any question. Verse 6, Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son. Now does that sound familiar? Isaac carried the wood. What did Christ carry? Let's go into John chapter 19. Keep your finger again there, please. John chapter 19, verse 17. "And he," Christ, "bearing his cross." So he's carrying this huge piece of lumber. How much it weighed, who knows? But he's carrying this huge piece of lumber. "Went out to a place called the place of a skull," which in Hebrew is Golgotha. But Christ carried his cross until he couldn't anymore and was helped. But Isaac carried his wood for that sacrifice. So going back to verse 6 of Genesis 22, "So Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son. And he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and the two of them went together." Now, they probably walked a little ways. And then Isaac spoke to Abraham in verse 7, his father, and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." And he said, "Look, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Isaac understood what a burnt offering was. He understood the things that were needed for the burnt offering. He sees the fire, he sees the wood, he knows that they're going to build the altar, but he doesn't see the lamb. He doesn't see the ram or the bull. There's no animal with them. So at this point, you have to be thinking, he's wondering, okay, where is this bull or this lamb that we're going to be sacrificing? Abraham answers in verse 8, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering. And the two of them went on their way. Now, I see this, and I'm not going to turn there. I see this with a parallel that when Christ was in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he's praying to his Father that this cup be passed from him, nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. And he said that three separate times. So there's this conversation between Christ and the Father about what was about to happen, just like this conversation between Isaac and Abraham about what is about to happen. Verse 9. Then they came to the place which God had told him. And Abraham built an altar there and placed the wood in order. And he bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood. Now let's stop and think about this for a minute. They've walked probably for several miles up a pretty good sized mountain. They're up at the top. Abraham has built the altar, unloaded the wood off of Isaac, laid the wood out in a way to where it would burn properly, and then he goes to his son with a rope and starts tying his hands together and starts tying his feet together. Let's think about something here for a minute. Did Isaac fight? Did Isaac fight Abraham while he was tying his hands and feet together and putting him on that altar? Did he fight? There's a comment that was made by Adam Clark in his commentary that I think was very fascinating with this. And he said, what must he have suffered while building the altar, laying on the wood, binding his lovely son, placing him on the wood, taking the knife, and stretching out his hand to slay the child of his hopes, the child of his, not just the child of his hopes, but the child of his promise, the child that was promised to him by God, that he now has a knife up over his child, laying on an altar, ready to cut the child's throat and kill him. His child. Every view we take on this subject interests the heart and exalts the character of this father of the faithful. But he has the But has the character of Isaac been duly considered? Is not the consideration of his excellence lost in the supposition that he was too young to enter, particularly into a sense of his danger, and too feeble to have made any resistance, had he been unwilling to submit? Now, you stop and think, he's going to be carrying a bunch of wood on his back. Let's just at least walk through a minimum age that Isaac had to be. But he's going to be carrying 40, 50, 60-pound load of wood on his back. Okay? How old would he have to be to do that and carry it up a mountain? 16? Somewhere in there, maybe? Post-pubescent, for sure. Well, the speculation that Adam Clark has from several sources is quite interesting with that. Josephus supposes that Isaac was now 25. So that would put Abraham as 125 years old. There are rabbis think that he was 36. And he could not have been really older than 36 because in the next chapter, Sarah died at 127 years old. She was 90 when Isaac was born. So it couldn't be older than 36. That's the absolute oldest that Isaac could have been. Now, Adam Clark says, but it is more probable that he was now about 33, the age at which his great antitype was offered up. Christ was sacrificed at 33. It's possible Isaac may have went through this at 33. Josephus said 25. Either way, you're looking essentially, almost everyone feels that he was an adult. He could have whipped all over Abraham, thrown him down the mountain, and said, I'm not going to go through this. Right? But did he? No. He went through and allowed his father to bind him and put him on that altar and have a knife over his throat ready to kill him. And then, verse 11, just as Abraham's ready to do what he was asked, the angel of the Lord called out from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. Here I am, he replied. Now, he's still probably still like this. And then we see that this is Christ a few verses farther down, actually, that's speaking. Verse 12, do not lay a hand on the boy, he said. Do not do anything to him. Now I know. It's definitive. No question about it. Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son. This proved Abraham's faith. He knew that God could resurrect Isaac. He had full confidence. He knew that God would keep his promise, that Isaac would be that son of promise. He absolutely knew it. And he went as far as he could go, and then he was stopped. Let's go back to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews 11 and verse 17. We see that it continues talking about Abraham and his faith. That there's really a very substantial part. There's about 11 verses that talk about the faith of Abraham in this chapter. But in verse 17 it says, by faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called. Accounting that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. Let's stop and think about, why does he say that? Because for 3 days, ever since he heard that from Christ, for 3 days, when he walked from Beersheba all the way to Moriah, for those 3 days, Isaac was as good as dead in his mind. And then he was stopped at the last second. There's some very interesting parallels with that, aren't there? About 72 hours. About Christ being in the grave, being dead to the Father for 3 days. Just as Isaac was dead to Abraham for 3 days. Also, we see that the parallel with Isaac being on the about to die, about to be that sacrifice, being a representation of the Passover. You can look at it either way, and it fits. Going back to chapter 22 of Genesis, verse 13, Abraham looked up, and there in the thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. Now, thickets generally are what? They're like briars, brambles, things like that. This ram is caught in these briars, which have thorns. Its head is caught in there. A crown of thorns, maybe, possibly. The representation there. Then he went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So God did provide. Remember what Abraham said a few verses back. What about the lamb? And Abraham said, God will provide. God did provide that ram. So Abraham called that place, the Lord will provide. And to this day it is said, on the mountain of the Lord it will be provided. Now, Adam Clark makes a comment here that I find, earlier we talked about how a lot of the people, the Jews in that, feel that the sacrifice was done where the temple is now. Adam Clark has a slightly different view on it, and it's something I've thought for years personally. And it says, from this it appears that the sacrifice offered by Abraham was understood to be a representative one, and a tradition was kept up that Jehovah should be seen in a sacrificial way on this mount. And this renders the opinion more than probable that Abraham offered Isaac on that very mountain on which in the fullness of time Jesus suffered. Because it was in the area of Moriah, when we look back at the start of the chapter, it says, go to the land of Moriah, which was a series of mountains, which is current-day Jerusalem. It was a place there. It is possible it was the temple. It was also possible it was where Christ was crucified. The parallels, when we look at the parallels with this, it's fascinating how this was a precursor of Christ's sacrifice. How Abraham had to be willing to sacrifice his son. And he was, to show his faith. Continuing in verse 15, then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time out of heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, in blessing I will bless you, and in multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven and the sand which is on the seashore. And your descendants shall possess the gates of their enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. Now, this last part of this, where does that come from? 12th chapter of Genesis. Same, a lot of the same things he said in the 12th chapter of Genesis. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 6. Hebrews chapter 6 has a lot of interesting things to say about Abraham. Really, a lot of the book of Hebrews has a lot to say about Abraham. And starting in verse 13 of Hebrews 6, it says, for when God made a promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, surely blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply you. And so, after he had patiently endured, he obtained the promise. So, Christ's war by himself. And he's the only one that can do something like that because he has the power to perfectly fulfill what it is that he swears. But he made that promise to Abraham. To wrap things up, I'd like to go to James chapter 2. And we see that Abraham is talked about as the father of the faithful. And we can see why. Because of what he was willing to do. That he was willing to give up his son as a sacrifice. Just like the father gave Christ as a sacrifice. Christ willingly gave of himself. Isaac didn't fight. He willingly allowed himself to be put at the point to where he was going to die. The parallels are fascinating. But it also shows something that we see here in the second chapter of James. Verse 17 of James 2. Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. Abraham proved his faith because he had the works. He was willing to give the thing he loved the most, physically, his son, as a sacrifice. Even though he realized Christ, God and Christ did not want human sacrifice. He realized that, but he was willing to do it. Verse 18, but someone will say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. Abraham showed his faith by his works. As we can see starting in verse 21. Was not Abraham, our father, justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar? Do you see that faith was working together with his works, and by works faith was made perfect? Abraham's faith was made perfect because of what he did. Faith requires works. You have to have both. You can't have one without the other. You have to see both sides. We have an elder brother who showed the ultimate faith in giving his life so that we may have eternal life. As we prepare for this Passover season, let us keep in mind that we need to grow in faith, and our works show our faith. But yet we also can look at Christ and we look at the Father and we look at this example of Abraham and Isaac and how they lived and how what they did in being willing to be that ultimate sacrifice, just as Christ was that ultimate sacrifice. So let us keep that in mind and grow our faith. Help our faith grow by the works that we go through. And to build a faith that is pleasing to God. And keep in mind that we have an elder brother who has shown the ultimate example in faith. And we have a father that has shown that he is willing to give all for each and every one of us.